This is Charlotte Adams interviewing John Larson for the USC Public History Program Archive. It is October 15th, 2016. All right, getting started. So I want to ask you how you first heard about or became interested in the field of public or applied history.
Right. When I first started looking at going back to graduate school, at that time I was not aware of any history program that offered what we now call public history. Most historians were in the academic realm and working in universities or maybe in high schools teaching history. But I had always been interested in the sort of tactile aspect of history. Outdoors, parks, you know, Civil War parks, those kinds of things. I particularly was interested in Civil War history. When I did my undergraduate work at USC, I thought I was going to be a Civil War historian. I studied under Tom Connolly, who was the Civil War historian at USC at the time, wrote my thesis on, or my senior paper on the Alabama claims dealing with the Confederate Navy. And when I went into the Army, you know, I continued to be very interested in the Civil War, collected Civil War artifacts and continued to study Civil War history. And so when I got out of the military in 1975, I thought, well, I would go back to school and become probably a Civil War historian and see what I could do with that, either work for the Park Service, possibly work as a historian at a university or something. I applied for graduate work in North Carolina, which is where I was stationed at the time at Fort Bragg. And I went back to South Carolina to get some letters of recommendation, particularly from Walter Edgar, who was still down at the school at the time, and had been supportive as an undergraduate. So I arrived there asking for letters of recommendation, and he started to explain to me about this program that was being commenced between the history department and the art department. John Bryan, who was faculty in the art department, and Walter Edgar, who was going to handle the history part of it. And it was going to be what they called applied history. And the name fascinated me. It just seemed to be so blue-collar, working-class, get out there, roll up your sleeves, and get the job done kind of history. And, you know, it wasn't going to be about getting paper cuts in the archives and researching documents. It was going to be out there in the real world. And that seemed very interesting to me. And then they promised, because the class had not been formed yet, they promised to have graduate assistant money. I was getting out of the military, so I had GI Bill. They were happy about that. And so it looked like I was going to be rolling in cash as a graduate student. And so I redirected my thought, and I redirected my thoughts. And ended up, I didn't really even have to hardly apply to South Carolina, because really what Walter Edgar did is recruit me. And I said, that's great. And I got out of, basically out of Fort Bragg, moved down to Columbia, took up residency in an apartment down there off of Fort Jackson Boulevard, and would undertake a year's worth of classwork at USC. And you want me to keep going here?
Sure.
Well, okay. So the history devolves, and it was a small class. I forgot how many there were in it. Maybe 8 of us, maybe 10. Not a lot. And as I recall, there were maybe 3 guys and maybe 6 women or something like that. We didn't know what we were doing. You know, it was pretty wide open. There were 3 tracks, allegedly. There was one dealing with historic preservation, there was one dealing with museum studies, and there was one dealing with archival work. And but we didn't know the difference. I mean, and at that point, there were a variety of classes being offered. All of them seemed relevant, and you sort of picked and choose. My little grumbling has been, and you'll hear this throughout my narrative probably, is they hadn't really embraced archaeology as one of the disciplines in dealing with history. And I had taken, I'd done archaeology, understand South at the University of South Carolina. I knew something of the value of historical archaeology was to understanding place and understanding material culture. And I thought, you should know something about archaeology if you're going to deal with history. It's an archive, you know, it's a type of document. So, you know, we didn't really have that. On the other hand, the program was designed, at least initially, as I perceived it, as pretty loose. There were a series of core courses you could take, art, history, American preservation, movement, there was archival studies, documents, and there was some core courses, and you sort of cobbled them all together. I don't think in the end of the day, you know, you'd end up with a MA in history or an MA in art still, and you didn't really end up with a MA in archival studies or an MA in museum studies. There were no certificates at that point. It was just a matter of taking courses and finding things that seemed relevant and interesting and putting together a program of study that sort of equipped you to go out and work in one of these fields outside of the classrooms. Seemed like a great idea. I loved it. And I'd spent 1 year at Columbia in classes, taking various courses. I don't even remember. I took John Bryan's art history course. I took Walter Edgar's historiography course, I think. I forgot what all courses I took. Then the game changer was, I was in McKissick Library and one spring day, and I noticed a ad for a course offered at UNC Greensboro. And it was a comprehensive course, theoretically, on a Southern material culture. And it was like, I don't know, some incredible number of credit hours, 6 credit hours or something outrageous. I said, wow, that's really great. And I thought, I'm going to be this hotshot Civil War historian. You know, I need to know something about Southern material culture. So I had been working with John Bryan and Walter a little bit on the Columbia Canal. And that had been sort of one of my projects. And I spent a lot of time looking at Robert Mills and his role on the Public Works Commission. And I'd been doing a lot of research in the library and in the art museum and anywhere I could find images of the canal. And I had been walking the canal and I'd found the old part of the canal that had not been modified and the new part that Ludlow had reworked for water power and all of that. And I was getting, and I had grown up on the banks of the Broad River in high school. And so I was sort of familiar with that area, and it had new depth and understanding and appreciation to me. And so, you know, this idea then of working on the Columbia Canal had connected me to buildings, and particularly, somebody's really calling me here, what is all of this about? It really began to make me think about architecture, and Walter Edgar had taken me under his wing to a certain degree, and we had gone, and they were tearing down a building in Columbia, an 1850s building, and we did salvage. I remember one Saturday, you know, he tried to actually get me in the Army Reserve, and I was useless because I didn't want anything more to do with the Army, but He was very good at mentoring students, and so one day we went out and we salvaged things out of this 1850s building, and that was the first time I had really engaged architecture, you know, as a topic. I was still thinking about everything in the context of Civil War and all of that, but you know, to get in a building and begin to get doors and, in this case, mantle parts and whatever that he was saving out of the building. Was kind of, you know, was interesting. It was a good bonding experience. So I get this idea of coming up here to Winston-Salem and taking this course with UNCG. Now, again, first time, this is 1976 at this point. This is the first time that this course had been offered at the Museum of Early Southern Decorative Arts. I don't know whether you know much about Early Southern Decorative Arts, but it's a Southern cultural, material culture museum that Old Salem operates. And so I come up here and get involved in the course. So we're housed over in Greensboro and we shuttle back and forth and whatever. And we're learning all about, you know, slave culture and material culture and what makes the South different. And, you know, it's great. It was all great stuff. And we had a project to do. And you had to pick an object or something to write about or elaborate on and define the social significance of and these sorts of things that material culture people do. And everybody was picking Charleston miniature paintings, or they were doing a little silver from, you know, silverware, silver from, you know, Baltimore, or they were furniture from Fredericksburg, Virginia. You know, So I sort of went back to my Robert Mills idea. I said, we're going to do brick. So I took brick as my material culture, and brick's great. It's such a great material, and you know, it's legendary. Everything from the Three Little Pigs to, you know, revolutions in France, and you know, people throw bricks. I mean, you know, it is an object that has had an impact on the world, and it goes way back, and it's very interesting. You know how it's manipulated. I don't know whether you know anything about brick, but I could go on forever about how brick is bonded and how, you know, how it's made and, you know, how it's implemented into buildings and the craftsmanship and, you know, the artisans go into that and ultimately how it defines architecture in a lot of ways. So I'm slowly drifting away from guns and drums and I'm getting into brick, you know, as material culture. Sitting in the audience at the time, when we did our presentations, was a guy by the name of Charles Phillips. And Charles Phillips was an architect from Texas who had been hired as the director of architectural restoration at Old Salem at the time. And he was basically a preservation architect. And I think he was as bored as I was with Charleston silver and miniature painting. And so that somebody would actually deal with architecture enthralled him. So he came up after my lecture, my talk, and said, you need to come to Old Salem and do your internship. And I said, well, I have to do an internship. But I'm in Columbia. I'm not in Winston-Salem. And, you know, I have a wife. And we have to move up here. And he said, that's all right. You know, we'll work that out. So sure enough, I ended up renting an apartment up here and moved out of Columbia and immediately talked to Walter Eggers. Said, I'm moving to Winston-Salem here. You know, I got two semesters of coursework in here. Mm-hmm. I haven't done my comps, haven't done my language requirements, have not, haven't finished my coursework, still haven't, but I will get my internship done and I will get a thesis topic out of this theoretically. He said, great, go, we'll work out everything else. And sure enough, he did. I mean, because what we did then is I did some correspondence, basically. I did selective reading courses, tutorials of sorts, and I would read books and I would write them up and whatever, and I would send them in and whatever, and I worked through my coursework. I came back the following summer and took the course on speed reading Spanish, basically, and got through that requirement, got through my language requirement, and then took the comps, basically, and got through that, and then it was writing up the thesis, mm-hmm. finishing the shoe shop and whatever. And that went on longer than Walter Egger could hardly stand. And finally he said, if you don't do it, if you don't finish it, then you're going to have to start over again. Well, that was a motivator. And I had basically, because it involved restoring the shop and whatever. So this was 1982, maybe. I'd have to go back and look. And I don't know whether anybody else had finished their thesis or not. I don't know whether what has happened to my classmates. I was gone. I wasn't in Columbia anymore. And I was working. And I had and by that point, Old Salem had flipped me from an intern, basically, into an assistant to the director of restoration. So I had sort of a job. And I couldn't find time to write it up. So finally got it written up. I think I had the distinction, you can probably look it up, but I think I had the distinction of having the first illustrated thesis in the public history program. Now this is before you had desktop publishing. This is when you had to shoot the photographs, you had to put the copy text on them. You had to bind them into the binder. You had to make sure the margins were 1¼ inches or whatever the hell they were. All those guidelines. We were still typing thesis then. I had to hire a typist because I can't type worth anywhere anything. And, I make too many mistakes. So you had to do that and all the footnotes, and you had to weave in because I was dealing with material culture. And I had wanted to talk about maps and documents and buildings and people and process. And so, I needed illustrations. I mean, I needed images. And so getting those into a thesis was a challenge. And you can go look at my thesis and think, it's really quaint now when you consider what is possible with desktop publishing. It would have been so much easier if I could have just dropped images in and worked the text around them and whatever. But at that point in time, the technology just wasn't there. And so to get the historical images, the photographs of Samuel Schultz, the photographs of the shop before it was restored, the Sanborn maps, and all the other things that needed to go into this document to record the building, had to be done manually. It was tedious as hell. And no wonder it didn't get done. But it finally did. Now, I think it was in 85, I finally got my thesis done. It was 10 years later or whatever it was, 9 years since my enrollment day. But got it under the line, got it signed, got my thesis done, and I was no longer a Civil War historian. I was locked in to these Moravians, who are, as you may have learned today, a bunch of pacifist Germans in the back country of North Carolina, which all South Carolinians hate, of course. Did not like Chapel Hill, did not like anybody up north of Shiraw. And here I was up here getting locked increasingly into this place and the restoration of the museum. Now, the other part of this, which we can get into, is I ended up in the museum world. And you have to understand that, the world of preservation shifted radically, as you can imagine, in the 1960s with the federal government involvement and all the tax credits and the National Register Program and all the SHPO offices and all the stuff that was coming out of that was changing the landscape of historic preservation in America. And here it was, I, who actually thought I might work for the Park Service, I didn't know what the hell I was going to do, found myself in a museum that was replicating to a large degree the Williamsburg model, which of course dates back to the 1920s. And so the idea of scrape philosophy versus non-scrape would be discussed. The idea of interpretation, restoration of a whole town as a museum experience, not as a rehabilitation project, not as a paint bucket, not as a back to the city, not as a sustainability study. All the other wagons that the preservation movement has hooked themselves to over the years, this museum has existed as a restoration effort, as a museum, and in a very unique sort of way. And I've ended up to a large degree then building a career of 37 years in this place with a break of about 3 years when I left the museum and went and worked with an architectural firm doing historic preservation work. And then the Old Salem came and made the mistake of hiring me back. And that was in 91. And so I've been here since 91, working on the preservation of this town. And that's basically the nuts and bolts of it. Now, you have another question? You want me to keep going
here? Well, I wanted to ask you if you thought that internship experience was sort of the jumping off point that really prepared you the most for what your career was going to be.
Well, I think there's no question about that it opened the door for me. I mean, what sort of opened the door for me in a way, I mean, as I morphed from Guns and Drums Civil War to place buildings and building materials and design and architecture. See, I've never been trained. People say, well, you're an architect, right? No, I'm not an architect. I am at best, and I'm not even sure I'm that, as an architectural historian. My training for architectural history is limited to one course that John Bryant taught. I mean, you know, that, you know, so I know, you know, Italianate from the Greek Revival. It has come from an experience of working in the field and particularly getting engaged in my world of vernacular studies, and that is the less formal aspects of architectural design. You know, I get into Renaissance, Italian Renaissance, and it's like, oh my God, I wouldn't have any idea how to even describe it, much less restore it, you know. But German backcountry, you know, I'm pretty damn good at this time, and understanding that. So the internship, you know, of course, was supposed to be one semester, you know, turned into God knows how long. One semester was impossible. And I ended up, of course, combining that with trying to throw on top of that the coursework, which the other semester would have been. So theoretically, you're supposed to get out of this program in 2 years. I had 1 year of classwork. I had basically two semesters of internship, one spread out semester of selective readings and directed courseworks and comps and all that other stuff that sort of spilled out over a period of time to get it done. I suppose you could do it in 2 years. I'm not sure that that's necessarily a good thing, because I think that the time that I had to develop into the career that eventually unfolded, I needed that time. I needed the time to restore that shop. I needed the time to do the research for the shop. It took me a while to even to identify that project in the context of the museum that I was getting engaged in. I think that the thing that was useful for me was that first semester, the first two semesters of coursework in Columbia, when I began to look at the Columbia Canal. And I'm not sure why I did, other than I had grown up alongside of it. I knew it was there, but I didn't know much about it. And it must have been under John Bryan's tutelage that I sort of picked it up. I don't think it was really Walter Edgar so much for that part, because John was the one that was doing architecture mostly, as under the art department. And so I think that gave me that academic presence of being at USC, having classroom, having the intellectual stimulation of reading with Heritage So Rich and, you know, Osmer's American Preservation Movement and all those classics, which you guys don't read anymore but should, provided the intellectual stimulation to begin to rethink a little bit about history and how to apply history in a way that I had not really envisioned before. And so that when I came and engaged material culture, my mind was already beginning to think about the other aspects of history other than the written part that the objects would tell stories, and that needed to be recovered. And I found that incredibly interesting, to be able to look at things and think about how they were made and what they meant and how they were used and why we discard them and whatever. There's a great quote that you need to, if you're going to stay in this profession, you need to look up. And I could, I don't have it here, but it's from the Grapes of Wrath. Are you familiar with that? And there's a quote in there, and you can find it, about the women that are sitting around the house and selecting objects to take to California. And they go through these objects, these material things of their life. And they are deciding what they'll keep and what they won't. And it's based in part on what memories these objects contain. And they'll talk about different things that they're trying to decide. Oh, I have this feathered hat and it always made me sneeze. And, you know, no, I really don't have room to put that on the truck. I'm going to leave that. And in the end, what they do is they pile all these other things, all these objects of their lives, and they pile them up and they burn them. And they drive away heading toward California. And sitting in the background of all of this is the cabin that they leave behind and the house which they'd occupied. And, you know, it's a powerful statement of memory and objects and how objects contain our past. And that aspect of material culture is what really fascinated me. And particularly, I thought architecture was the ultimate of the material objects, because it doesn't move around, it doesn't get hauled out to California and sold under auction or whatever. Generally, buildings stay put. So if you want to look at a material culture, if you want to look at a value system, if you want to look at a hierarchy of space, if you want to look at gender issues, if you want to look at racial issues, you start looking at the built environment, and then you have an index for that. And that's what eventually drove me into the architectural field, of using buildings to understand values and culture. And particularly for the Moravians, it's just like in your face. So, and the restoration of the town has allowed me then to explore that. So that's what we've been doing.
All right. Well, you've talked about this a bit, a lot actually, but I wanted to ask you about your career since, you know, getting your thesis and going on and working at Old Salem for such a long time. And I also saw that you did some projects with architectural history with Monticello and
Phillips and Opperman. Yeah, when I left Old Salem, I went and worked again with Charles Phillips, who was running an architectural firm called Phillips and Opperman, two architects. They were classmates in Texas. And they developed a preservation firm. And so for 3 years, I worked with them on buildings, and that included the initial evaluation of Montpelier. I worked with Miles Bruton House in Charleston, worked with Fayetteville Market House. I led the charge on Fayetteville Market House, National Landmark Building, Stratford Hall, White House of the Confederacy, a Latrobe building out in Senator Pope's house out in Lexington. These were all historic buildings, incredibly interesting buildings of significance. A Decatur House in Washington, D.C. I mean, it's great projects. And, you know, I enjoyed it. It was great work. And I learned a lot. I got to work with, again, building, hone the diagnostic, building diagnostic skills mostly, how to read a building, how to understand building technologies, how to understand evolution of buildings, and how to read them, basically. And that was valuable to me professionally. Probably as valuable as anything for me. And then I'd come back to Old Salem. Basically, I got tired of traveling around. You know, when you start thinking you deserve to be in first class when you're flying, you know, I want to upgrade to first class. You know, I'm tired of driving around in steerage. You know, you've been traveling too much. I had a daughter, a wife, and I was way on the road way too long and doing these projects all over the country. And so when Old Salem came back to me right across the way here, you know, I'm right here in the neighborhood, it seemed like a logical thing to do. And so I resigned from that vice president's position at Phillips and Opperman architectural firm and took up the vice presidency at Old Salem, basically. So that's the only really interruption Now, I was thinking back as I retired, I've really only had two or three jobs in my whole career. I was in the military. Well, I started out as a produce handler at Winn-Dixie grocery store. That was really what launched me into material culture. Beyond that, I was in the military and then, you know, graduate school and then Old Salem and then the architectural firm in Old Salem. And that's pretty much it. You know, that's pretty much what my life has been here. And maybe I'll be city councilman come November. But, you know, other than that, it's a pretty boring, simple, straightforward sort of life. Yeah.
How are we doing on time?
I'm fine for now.
Okay.
Yeah, it was only 6 o'clock, right? Yeah, so we'll get a bite to eat it. Whenever, I mean, whatever you want to do.
So, at the time that you were in the program, it was applied history, and then sort of shifted into public history. What do you think about the...
It's awful. This is the problem, though. This is all about marketing and nomenclature. And Walter Edgar and John Bryan had a brilliant idea. But unfortunately, they were just behind the wave, apparently. And the idea of the terminology of applied history did not catch fire. The term public history, somehow or another, did. I'm not sure exactly how that occurred. I was asleep at the wheel. I don't know. It didn't matter. But before I knew it, you know, everything's doing public history. And I have, you know, I don't like the term. I don't think the public understands what it is. I don't think that it really helps the field much as far as the relevance of history. I mean, if you want to make history relevant to modern living and a broader population, applied history is pretty self-explanatory. Yeah, well, what does it mean? Well, it means archival work. It means probably, it means working at museums. It means, you know, saving our downtowns. It means, you know, all kinds of things, you know, parks and recreation, whatever. Great. Public history. What is public history? Well, I know what public housing is. I know what public restrooms are. I know what public transportation is. So this public history is about the history of the public, right? Is that what that's about? You know, and this is my own snooty attitude, and you're just going to have to live with it, because it, you know, I'm an old goat, and that wave is gone. But I do think there's a lost opportunity in the sense of how it's marketed, and I think there's a real crisis right now in the history profession, which some people would say there is in America. Then you have to ask, how do you market yourself, and what do you say you do? And I say applied history makes history work, and it's blue collar, and it gets out there, and it has some relevance to our daily lives. Public history doesn't mean anything to me as a term. And I've never considered myself a public historian. You know, I consider myself an applied historian at the University of South Carolina, and at this point, a museum person. Pretty much it.
With the three original tracks, mm-hmm. were you... museums or preservation?
I really wasn't. I never declared. Yeah. I never declared. I never had to. You know, I wasn't there long enough, I guess, for the first year. You know, it was sort of loosey-goosey. First time anybody had taught any courses. I was never even there for the second wave. You know, a second class getting hired. You know, just I wasn't there long enough. So I never, I ended up in museums. You know, but this is the other point. This is the other point of this, is that let us not confuse the role of museums in historic preservation. And the thing that I have advocated for most of my career in all of these public history programs is that when you start separating museums from public history preservation programs, start separating, setting museums aside from the mainstream of historic preservation, preservation does that at its own peril. And in that, preservation has relied on museums to anchor, basically, America's perception of history and historic sites. And so, you know, yes, you can take downtowns and turn any cotton mill into a Ghirardelli Square, or you can make it, you know, condominiums, or do any tax act projects you want. But then that's fine. We all know that the economics of that, and get into this rant. But, you know, the idea of where of keeping history in historic preservation still resides to a large part on America's museums. And America's museums still provide the public educational components, still provide the public access to history, still provide the research to a large degree that a lot of Preservation Tax Act projects have very little to do after the National Register nomination is written. You know, that gets done, gets filed in the SHPO office, gets sent off to the Park Service, they get the tax credits, and nobody knows what the hell that building was in the first place. And my rant is that if we really care in historic preservation about history, then my question is, within the preservation movement, and I see this even in the National Trust, is history still prevalent, or are we, what we're really talking about now is economic rehabilitation? And if that's what this field has become, then it's not, you know, it's drifted away from the history theme, and I think it, again, at some peril, because it is the history that gives relevance and anchor to place and buildings. It's not just about inserting a flower shop into a storefront. It's about whether or not that place contributes to our understanding of our past. And you know all this propaganda, but you know, this is really the question. And I challenge every time this comes up in a discussion as to why the hell we don't have a requirement for Tax Act projects, National Register projects, whatever, to say something about how a building was used originally. You know, we spend all this money on creating condominiums and old tobacco factories, and there's no statement about the strike that occurred on civil rights in this particular tobacco factory in 1912, you know, when they had to, in Winston-Salem, they had to pull out the Gatling gun to make sure whatever, that the riot didn't get out of control. You know, now we got nice condos there. That's great. Great Tax Act project. Great, the building's saved. Fine. You know, is that what we're about now, though? Is that ultimately what we're about? And this, so it's about economics. You know, it's about tax credits. It's about economic viability. The undergirding of the preservation program right now is tax credits. It's not history. It's not a moral imperative. You know, it's not like we're saving these buildings because they're really important to our understanding place and time and what differentiates Winston-Salem from High Point, you know, which is why Old Salem got saved, is because thought that there was something worth remembering here, you know. And so the hazard that I see right now if our preservation program is so linked to tax credits and the whole National Register structure, which is problematic too, I mean, we ran on that in a minute, but you know, if it's all hooked to that, that's a pretty dangerous ledge to be on, because we already know, and it's happened in North Carolina already, that the state legislature and probably the federal government giving a chance will eventually cut that stuff back. And when it does, we already hear the hue and cry about, oh, we can't save old buildings because, oh, we have to have underwriting, we have to have preservation money to make it work. Well, bullshit. You know, that's not, you know, we're at the trough now, and we've got ourselves addicted to this idea that we have to have tax credits to save old buildings. And it just ain't so. It just isn't so. And museums have been doing it for years with no tax credits. Truly, you can't have all museums. Got that. Don't need to convince me of that. But you've got to understand, too, that there's got to be something deeper than the bottom cash line of a project development to make our preservation project worthwhile. And the challenge I would have, I ran on this, is compare ourselves to the environmental movement and the moral imperatives and the values that are instilled in the environmental movement, which started largely at the same time historic preservation started, almost within a year or so. You know, as you look at Earth Day and the other things that developed out of that, what is the difference? What has happened to the two tracks through time if you were to do a comparison of it? And I think most people, oh, recycling is really good. Is there an economic incentive for you to put your trash out in there? No, I don't want to do that. you know, oh, we should have, you know, we shouldn't be using as much petroleum. We're going to, you know, we're ruining the air. All right, we are, fine. So now preservation's trying to figure out how to hook onto that wagon. They're trying to say, oh, we're all about sustainability. You know, we're all about the best, you know, the most environmentally responsible building is a building already built. Fine. Fine. You know, that's great. And we'll play that. And when was the gas shortage in the 1970s? You know, what did the National Trust use? Oh, we used a gas can in the shape of a building. You know, oh, we can save money if you don't, you know. Or you know, if we have a monetary crisis of some sort, you know, old buildings are more economical. You know, you can revitalize the downtown, paint bucket programs, you know, tax bases, whatever. You know, we hook our identity to anything but history. Is where the field's going right now, and that's because, well, history's handled by museums, so we don't need to worry about that. And we know that museums can't save the world. So we're going to let the museum sort of do that over there. And meanwhile, real preservation is about saving the downtown, saving our neighborhoods, National Register nominations, surveys, you know, that sort of stuff. If we're lucky, we'll get a planner and planning department that deals with historic preservation. We'll establish a commission, Historic Preservation Committee, or Historic Resources Commission, something in the city. We'll regulate the hell out of neighborhoods. We'll control what happens there. You know, and all of this in the name of what? In the name of what? And so residents get angry because they can't, you know, put changes to the houses, and they don't understand why they can't. And there's going to be, my fear is, there's going to be a backlash, and it's going to be about property rights. We're already seeing it. You know, and there's going to be people because they don't understand why preservation is valuable and why they should respect, the buildings that have been given to them from the past to the present that they are now the stewards of, and what's encapsulated in those buildings, not just in energy and sustainable blah blah, but in the history and the identity of a place, and respecting something that has been given to us by our forefathers, given to us, and we should give it the same respect that we would like my daughter, my grandchildren, to respect whatever I do. And if we don't have respect for our past, why would we think anybody in the future would respect anything that we do? And this is the problem right now that I'm seeing in historic preservation, because we haven't figured out yet. After all these years, we're still struggling, and we're relying on regulations, we're relying on tax credits, we're relying on zoning issues. We have bureaucratized ourselves to make preservation an integral part of our world. In some regards, yeah, we saved a ton of buildings. You say, Larson, look at all the stuff. Look at all the buildings we've saved, and train stations and skyscrapers and rehab stuff. I got it. Totally got it. But there's something else that we're missing here. And I don't know how we capture it. I work in the museum world. I work in interpretation every day. You know, telling people why a place is important and why buildings are, particularly why buildings can tell us something about our past and how that technology and how those values are expressed in a physical form in our landscape today and what that means to us today, because they did it then and they've given it to us today. And that's, you know, that's what's going on. You probably didn't get any of this over there because nobody, you know, it's a difficult thing sometimes to convey. It's so much easier to say, oh, look at that, that's old fireplace, and oh, rippled glass, and, you know, it's an old brick, and, you know, yeah, and very quickly go to an aesthetic without actually going any deeper in saying, why, you know, what does this gas station mean? Why is this gas station here in this part of town? And why did it not survive? Or if it did survive, how it changed? And, you know, just take anything, I mean, material culture, but take a building and say, why is this important? Why is a shotgun house important? What does it mean? Why do blacks not want to live in it today? You know, what is it about, I don't know about in Greensboro or High Point or, you know. I remember when I was working, initially in Columbia, working on Columbia Canal. And out near where the fairgrounds is now, and out near where the stadium was, was, I can't remember the name of it, it was a working mill town. There was a mill town there. And it's probably still there. It's not Shandon, that's the other, Shamrock, maybe? Anyways, it's that area, it's between the river and where the stadium is, and sort of back behind, back, coming back toward town. And there's a whole residential area of working class mill houses there. And I remember going, when I was working on the canal, I went into that area because the canal sort of skirted the edge of it. And you know, these people didn't want to live there. They didn't like it. They thought they wanted to get out of there.
You know, for near, like Olympia and Granby.
Olympia. Mm-hmm. That's exactly where it is. And I think it's all gentrified now. I think it's all flipped and it's got to be very fashionable.
Big mill is an apartment complex.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And this happens in North Carolina everywhere too. But, you know, so that area was going to go into transition, and you had an original population there, you know, who wanted to get out, you know, and now you got people coming in. And is that a good thing? Yeah, I think it's a good thing. Gentrification. Yeah, it's a good idea. You got, well, what are you going to do? I mean, you know, economics, we live in a capitalist world. So, yeah, this idea of trying to understand context of buildings, value of buildings, the history of Olympia is incredibly important in understanding the post-Civil War industrialization of Columbia. And, you know, that needs to be the story. It doesn't matter who's living there now, as far as I'm concerned. But if they don't understand why that's there and what those little houses represent instead of cute little cottages that starter couples live in at, you know, $190,000 or whatever they cost probably, you know, they'd be astonished, you know. So this is where I worry about historic preservation at this point. And you know, I worry about museums. Museums are suffering horribly right now, in part because history is so devalued right now within our society. And we have this horrible ahistorical, I think it's been called historical illiteracy or amnesia, I think is the term that's been used, on American history. And it goes right back to the academics, it goes back to universities, it goes back to Common Core testing values in our high schools and other school systems that have removed history as a core value in our society. And there are a variety of reasons for that, and I'm not going to go into that tirade right now, of which the academy can take a good chunk of blame for. Just as preservationists can take a big chunk of blame right now, if in fact there's a backlash of private owners, property owners who do not want to be regulated any longer. They're not even willing to have their houses designated because they're afraid that the federal government is going to come in and start, you know, ruling what kind of paint they can put on the buildings. Deal with that right now. We just enlarged our national landmark here at Old Salem. Yeah. And, you know, I heard this. You know, the federal government messing with me. Mess with you. They have any idea. Yeah, the common people don't have any idea what historic preservation is about, except that, oh, well, you know, it's old buildings. That's kind of cool. And, there's a nostalgia factor in there. And then regulatory.
If history is so devalued, what would you say is the value of history? Why is it so important? I mean, obviously, I share your opinion, but...
Yeah, well, first of all, you cannot have... you can't have a society... Who was the famous historian that said, you know... Borstein? That's right. Basically, trying to plan your future without the past is like trying to plant a garden of pick flowers or something. You know, it's like you have got. That's not the quote. I'll find it for you if you want. I'll send it to you. we've got to have an understanding of who we are, with all the flaws. I'm not glossing over the injustices or the problems that history can reveal. This is not a trip on nostalgia. On the other hand, you've got to find common ground somewhere. You know, if you want a country that has any cohesiveness, you've got to understand what it is that you've got. You know, and if you don't have at least a common platform for discussion, whether it be slavery, whether it be personal rights, or Second Amendment rights, you know, evolution of women's rights, African American history, take any subject, it has a past. You know, and we are here today based on, in part, that past. And if you don't understand that past, how can you possibly comprehend what we are doing today in any kind of rational context? And what you end up doing then is making knee-jerk responses, like certain presidential candidates who basically fly off with whatever opinion they have at the time. And it's not based on any understanding of Constitution, law, history, anything. You know, it's just, this is my opinion, and I think we ought to do it, and you know, hell with the courts or anything else. And so, you know, you sort of have to say, you know, we're moving through time. And it's a perpetual process. And some things we have direct contact with. I still remember the 50s. You think that's a great nostalgic era, you know, and that's where the National Register is going now, and we're all about ranchers, and we're all about split-level neighborhoods, and God knows what. So, you know, to me, you know, that's current events. You know, for me, that part of history is not the same way you look at history, because we have these overlapping periods, which is good. It's absolutely the way it's got to be. And yet I will go back further, and I strive now to understand what my parents were doing during World War II. You know, I've gotten very interested, now that my parents are gone, you know, to understand what the 30s and 40s were like. My father went through the Depression. My mother went through the Depression. My father was in World War II. You know, and trying to understand that. Then I can jump back even further and say, you know, well, my grandfather, you know, came from Czechoslovakia. And then I make the Moravian connections, and then I get all this tangled up, and my mother was christened in the Moravian church, and what does this mean to my life, you know, right now, as somebody who's working to preserve the story of that presence, that heritage, that Moravian heritage in a small part of the world that had nothing to do with Iowa, had nothing to do with Czech Republic particularly, but and yet all connects together in this matrix. And so I think, you know, it's a cliche, but, you know, you can't know where you're going to go in the future if you don't have some idea where you've been, you know, a little bit. You kind of, you know, you know a little bit, at least yesterday, okay, fine, the week before, where I was last year, where I was 2 years ago, you know, well, what about if you keep going back? You know, why is the South like it is? You know, why do we remain a part of this country that is so culturally identifiable? You know, these sorts of questions, you know, are those sort of things that make me want to study history and say, well, why do we drink iced tea that's sweet down here? Or why is barbecue so important? Or why is NASCAR? Why the hell do we have NASCAR here in North Carolina? Yeah, well, maybe trace it back to horse racing. You know, maybe you can trace it all the way back to the equestrian events that Southerners love so much, hunting and racing and stuff that you don't see in New England, and that competition, that sense of competition, is that one of the connections? And I love the thought of trying to think about that. And then as you go to Camden and you look at the steeplechase races over there, whatever, think about NASCAR. You know, and what are those kind of connections of Southern mentality that create this environment that we live in today? That's fascinating stuff. It's horribly amusing.
All right. Well, got some wrap-ups.
Okay.
Well,
right.
No, not well. Maybe the last.
Have I passed so far? Am I, you know, A minus, maybe B plus, yeah, something.
Great. We don't give minuses.
Oh, you don't.
So I wanted to ask you why you decided to volunteer to be interviewed for this this project.
Because I was asked. I don't have a lot. I used to have a lot of contact with USC. Walter Edgar would bring the class up, and I would rant with them and tour them around Old Salem and talk about egalitarianism in colonial America and how Moravians strayed into the capitalistic world of, you know, free enterprise and slavery and all of that. You know, and that was great. And then he, you know, he eventually left applied public history. I think about the time it switched over, come to think of it, and he went to Southern Studies, and then Carterville and other people would take over the South Carolina program, and I became less and less contact with them down there. I always thought it was a great program. Obviously, I came out of it. But it involves a love-hate as well, in a way, because the name changed. It became seemingly less technical in building technologies and the sorts of things that I was interested in. John Bryan retired, I guess, and the sense of architectural studies, or how to read a building, how to look at a building as a object of material culture. South Carolina didn't seem to be providing much of that. I got involved more heavily with a program over at UNC Greensboro, and tried to, and for a number of years, incorporated archaeology into their program, and incorporated building. I ran a field school summer field school in building technologies, you know, make mortar and cut glass and shingle roofs and how to repoint buildings and highline mortar and all, you know, basically the sorts of things that I found valuable when I tried to look at a building and understand more than just the stylistic signatures on it, but understand the technologies and the craftsmanship that were involved and the detailing that those artisans would leave as traces of their hands on the building. And South Carolina wouldn't do much of that, didn't seem to anyway. Charleston Building Technologies College of Charleston was doing some. Clemson was sort of easing into that down in Charleston. So, you know, the relevance of what South Carolina was doing also seemed to shift a little bit more into what's happening in the field generally, and that is a National Register tax credit, survey work, you know, the institutionalization of preservation. I did not have any contact with the museum side particularly. I lost that, just didn't occur. So, but I watched you guys, you know, and I sent people to you, and, you know, because it still was a very strong program. Compared to, you know, anything like Mary Washington, of course, was doing it for undergraduates. And, you know, they had a more technical aspect for undergraduate studies, which I thought was pretty interesting. And I knew faculty there as well. So, you know, it's just, I sort of drifted away. And now that my career is over, this is my last statement for oral history, to say it should have stayed applied history. I'm old guard. It should have stayed. It should have stuck with that name, but they weren't brave enough to do that because they didn't want to fight the tsunami of the bureaucracy of the intellectual world, of the academic world, of universities that started all these programs throughout the where everybody is starting public history programs. And South Carolina wasn't brave enough to carry the flag of applied history as their public history. And they succumbed to that pressure of calling it public history. And that's fine, but that's not what I am.
So what would you like to see our program do in the future to, I don't know, get back on track or just to go forward in training applied or public history?
I think this is what I would recommend, two things. I would recommend that anybody that's going to do site work, if they're going to be a historic site manager, if they're going to go into the museum world, they need access to our historic archaeology, and the idiots to go and take responsibility for a major site in America and not understand the value of historic archaeology. I don't care how they do it. They can do it in a field school. They can do it in a classwork. But they need exposure to that, and I don't think they're doing that still. And I fought this fight over at Greensboro for a long time and successful, but less so now. Second thing I would recommend is that if you're going to deal with buildings, you need to have a good understanding of how buildings are built and the technologies that are involved that differentiate the different time periods within a building. So that when you start asking questions of this building, that you can dissect the different periods and understand what the changes through time that have occurred. Now, here comes the fundamental problem. And that deals with scrape versus non-scrape and continuum, which is the ongoing argument that we have in the field. As long as continuum is the dominant philosophy of how we look at place in saving things, that everything is equal and that we should save basically the continuum story on sites, you don't have to differentiate anything. You don't really have to understand that this represents, you know, the 18th century and this represents the 19th century and this represents the early 20th century, whatever, because it's all one story and you don't have to be too precise as to where those edges are, right? So you don't really need to understand the difference between, you know, cut nail, wrought nail, and wire nail technology, or, you know, saw marks, or whatever else, whatever stylistic, the quirk in a molding that's in the side of a thing. You don't need to have the indicators of change in style and technology at that level of knowledge, because you're not having to make those kinds of decisions. In fact, very rarely will anybody spend the time to try to really understand what the changes actually are. Because nobody wants to scrape a building anymore. You don't want to take it back to a different period. That's disrespectful in preservation to a large degree now. And so, if you know, you don't need to understand the building if you're not going to take any part away from it. You follow this argument? So why bother to be informed about joining, how buildings are built up, or how framing systems work, or nailing patterns, or anything that would allow you to differentiate a period, because you're not going to have to determine what period is more significant than another period, because it's a continuum, right? It's just all the same. So why worry about it? Photograph it, say it looks great. It was built in 1793, had some alterations to it. We can record those on Sanborn maps and, you know, let rock and roll. Now, if you have to make the decision, which museums still do, much to the dismay of many preservationists, that you are going to actually scrape this building and you're going to take it back to an earlier period, then you better damn well be informed about what the hell you're giving up. And you better be pretty confident in what you're going to take this building back to, that in fact it has some sense of authenticity. And the biggest argument that's occurred over was Montpelier, which was recently a restoration which had been fought for over years after it was donated to the National Trust, and eventually the decision was made, in fact, to restore it to the Madison period. I don't know if you guys follow any of this or not. But over big arguments over whether that was worth doing and whether, in fact, you know, we needed another presidential house, and whether James Madison's house was all that important, or whether the DuPont additions to that house were as important as James Madison's house was. Or could you do both of them? Well, the damn fact was, you can't do both of them. If you want to understand James Madison and his house and his architecture and his values and how he occupied and what happened there, you need James Madison's house. You don't need to have the DuPonts thrown in on top of it to the point that it's unrecognizable. And that argument existed over years, and as a study, you can go at some point and go look at it. And I was involved in those arguments. I am still not afraid to scrape, because I think clarity is useful for the public. And I think continuum as an argument is a very weak argument, if that's all you can come up with. I mean, you're going to be different when you walk out the door tonight than you were 2 hours ago. It's a continuum. You know, it doesn't matter. It all changes. Is that the only important story we have to tell? You know, if there is an important story encapsulated in a building that needs to be redeemed and brought forward as a primary story, then that should trump the idea of all this other little stuff that goes on. Yeah, everybody loves asbestos siding, fine, you know, but does that on an 18th century building really help us understand, you know, what was going on in that period of time? It just doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, every building, every time period has its own buildings. Every time period has, you know, the now modern buildings. There have been modern additions to older buildings. You know, do we need to keep modern additions to older buildings when we have good examples of modern buildings with their own integrity and their own clarity and their own design and whatever? Unless there's something very significant about that addition that changes the value of the story. That doesn't mean you can't have multiple time periods, but you ought to look at them and ask, what is the weighting of those? And just because they exist through time, to me, doesn't impress me. You know, what I ask of a building is, what is the highest, best story that this building can tell about its occupancy on this God's little green earth? And that is what we want to get to. We want to get to that nut. And the fact that it has all kinds of accretions and other crap around it, you know, well, fine. Yeah, okay. They changed through time. Got it. You know, they changed the siding, or they put Italianate on it, or they did whatever to it. That doesn't mean anything, because that happens all over the world. Everything changes through time. Everything's a continuity. Everything's a continuum. You know, there's got to be something more to that. And that's part of the question about historic preservation is, you know, are we copping out by really focusing on what's valuable with our buildings and telling the public that's what's valuable, or are we just putting everything on the National Register we possibly can, because we can right now, because we can do that. And we can say, this is the best, you know, mid-20th century neighborhood in Umpty-Ump, North Carolina. You know, it's got 40 houses, all of them are built within a 50-year period. And if this nomination lasts long enough, you know, we can push this nomination all the way up to 1967. Because right now we're only at 50 years, you know. But if we wait another year, we can add these other houses, or I can do whatever. You know, right now what we're doing is we're trying to use preservation. You know, we're capturing all this mid-19th century stuff. And I have a little problem with that. Called 20th century stuff. I have a little problem with that, because my problem is, when the National Register started in the 1960s and we were first starting to put stuff on there, most of the stuff that went on there at least had been vetted a certain amount of time. Most of it had been vetted 150 years or more. All this stuff from the, you know, 18th century, 19th century, throwing all the Greek Revival stuff on there, whatever, little mumbling about, you know, bungalow neighborhoods in the 30s and whatever. I remember those, you know, but they were going on there. You know, now, you know, is 50 years long enough to vet architecture? Particularly when most of the architecture, you know, in America, like 80% of it is post-World War II, you know? I mean, what are we ending up with? Are we, in fact, creating a record of architectural history in this town, in this country? Or are we just busying ourselves with every time the calendar flips, we can add another year to our story? I don't like the 50 years. I think 50 years is stupid and arbitrary. And I think that, you know, if a building has historical merit, it should be put on immediately. You know, if Reagan shot in front of a 1900 hotel or whatever, 50 hotel or whatever it is, you know, what is important here? Mm-hmm. And if there's an important historical event, it doesn't matter what the hell the age of the building is. To me, if it's historical. And I, you know, pretty well can tell whether something's historically important. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
All right. Do you have...
Is there a rant you enough? Is that a big enough rant? You're not going to retype all this stuff. You had to edit this stuff out. And...
We'll see. Do you have any questions that you wished I would have asked you for you to answer that you think are important for the record?
No, I pretty well ran it on this. I mean, we've covered, you know, the idea of scrape and non-scrape. We've covered the idea of what is public history, you know, and how and where is the history... in public history. I got really upset with the National Trust for a while because they changed their publication to call Preservation. You know, I'm going, okay, is that jams and jellies or what? Well, preservation of what? I mean, what are we doing here? You know, where's the history? I keep looking, where's the history? It's what I keep asking everybody. I said, show me the history in historic preservation, and then we've got, you know, then we've got a story to talk about. Otherwise, I love economic rehabilitation. I'm running for city council right now. We've got to create jobs. We've got to revitalize the downtown. We've got all kinds of things. Is that historic preservation? Is that historic preservation? Or is it simply economic rehabilitation using available resources and under the banner of sustainability or whatever argument you want to make about it? Doesn't mean it's not valuable. Doesn't mean that it doesn't have a function. But it's economic rehabilitation. It's environmentally responsible. It's whatever else you want to say about it, but if there's no history in it, it's not historic preservation. And so, show me the history. You know, regardless of what it is. Museums still do that. Obviously, I'm biased. You know, history museums are still the point of the spear. And let preservation be damned if they start marginalizing museums, because museums are still the source that the public goes to connect the built environment to their lives and the history of a community. They don't go down to Jared Dilley Square thinking, oh, I'm going to go get some history, you know. I'm going to go down there and buy some chocolate, you know. And that's great. It's a great building. I'm not, you know, I don't walk away thinking I hate Jared Dilley Square, Faneuil Hall, or anything. But it's like, you know, is that part of it? Now, yeah, I mean, in the big picture, ultimately, that these buildings stay around, they're given life, they're given the opportunity to continue to contribute to the streetscape and the subliminal identity, that's where the power is the power that somehow or another, when you go down 4th Street in Winston-Salem, or you go down in whatever street in whatever town, and you are centrally bombed with these facades from the 19th and 20th, early 20th century, it imprints, I'm sure it imprints in your psyche some sense of identity, some sense of, I like to think, well-being, some sense of relationship to your town and your place. I understand that. But I don't think it totally gets us as preservationists to where we need to get to. That makes any sense at all.
Makes sense.
And so what we need to do is continually remind people as to why history is important. And we need serious help from the academic world to help us do that. Not marginalizing people, not dividing issues, not going to, you know, I'm going to write my dissertation on underwater mess kit repair units in the Confederacy. You know, we need people that can write histories that are relevant and relatable. And nobody, it's harder and harder for people to do that today, seemingly out of the field. And we could talk about that separately. But, you know, the historians today are challenged in a lot of ways to write histories that people will go to other than the History Channel or some places like that, which seems to be where people are going now to get their history. Museums have an incredible challenge of relevancy, but they have the one advantage that historians don't, and that tomorrow I can go to Salem and I can flip the story to whatever we need to talk about. Because generally, if you have the place, you have the stage, you can develop the story there. And that's that educational component that is not possible in a populist way in the universities. And that's why I don't teach in classrooms. That's why I work for a museum.
Okay. This seems like a good
end for that.
Good end for that. All right. Let's...